It's Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret, here with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a look at what happens when advertising and marketing goes wrong with an attempt at cultural relevance that rubs everyone the wrong way.
First, the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity sent a letter to each state last month requesting voter information such as birth dates, party affiliation, the last four digits of Social Security numbers, and more. Since then, many states, including Wisconsin, have refused to turn over this data.
And now all states have been told to hold off on providing that information, pending a lawsuit brought by an electronic privacy advocacy group, which is challenging the legality of the commission's request.
Ken Mayer is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and an affiliate of the Elections Research Center. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, remind us how this commission, this voter fraud panel came to be.
It emerged out of the claim by the president that between 3 and 5 million people had voted illegally in 2016. So he created this advisory commission ostensibly to study the integrity of voter registration records. And I have to say, to preface this, that there's exactly zero evidence that there were 3 to 5 million people who voted illegally. So this whole effort is not taken remotely seriously by anybody who studies elections or who understands election security. And I think that's one of the reasons that even before they pulled the request in response to this lawsuit, that many secretaries of state and state election authorities were skeptical and unwilling to turn over a lot of the information that the commission requested.
So why exactly does this commission want this voter information, both the public aspect of this information and the private aspect of it?
We don't really know, and that's one of the problems, that the commission has not made clear what it intends to use the information for. And that's one of the problems and the reason why the Electronic Privacy Information Center has filed this lawsuit. What seems to be the most likely set of things that the commission is going to do is that if they obtain voter registration information from the roughly 160 million registered voters in the country, what they intend to do probably is to compare the lists in states to see how many people, or to try to estimate the number of people who might be registered in multiple states, and presumably to use that to make unwarranted claims about the number of fraudulent voters. And it's pretty clear that the commission doesn't, they don't appear to have anybody on their staff who knows what they're doing or who knows how to do this, and there are a lot of existing efforts to try to help states manage their voter registration lists. But among the people who study elections and voter registration and the administration of these voter lists, that seems to be the most likely thing, to try to make claims about the number of people who are listed on more than one state's registration rolls.
And meanwhile, the legal challenges are mounting. At last check, 5 lawsuits brought against this integrity commission. What particular is this, the commission, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, what are they challenging?
Their claim is that the commission is not following federal law on the collection of information, and the collection in particular of electronic information. That there is a 2002 law that requires the federal government, when it's trying to collect information over computer networks, to protect the privacy of that information and to have a plan in place that the public can see and comment on. And there are some other requirements about the activities of federal advisory commissions, and even when the federal government tries to collect information, they have to go through some steps. And so EPIC is claiming that because the commission has not gone through this process, that they're breaking the law and they shouldn't be permitted to collect the information. And the commission's response is, at least on the EPIC lawsuit, is fairly technical, arguing that this organization doesn't have standing to file a lawsuit and that the advisory commission is not an agency under federal law. So there's a lot of technical information or technical disputes over what the statute means. What they've done is, in part because the federal judge has indicated that the court wants more briefings, that they have stopped the collection effort.
In its tracks.
In its tracks. And from what we can observe, the process seems to be pretty haphazard and sloppy. People were complaining that the website or the FTP site that they were using was not secured. And again, as I said earlier, nobody really knows precisely what they want to do with this information. And there's a lot of sensitive information there with birth dates and Social Security information that would need to be very, very carefully protected. And there's no indication that they've even thought about how to do that.
And we should also clarify that the Electronic Privacy Information Center, or its acronym EPIC, is not the same EPIC that does the electronic medical records in business in Verona. Those are two separate things going on.
That's correct.
Yes. And in your opinion, does this Electronic Privacy Information Center, do they have a strong case against the request?
Well, I'm not really the best person to assess that because, in part, a lot of it involves the how to interpret the statutes. What I do know from the work that I and others have done on voter lists and voter registration is that there is no chance that this effort is going to produce reliable information. And we know that because the process of trying to match large data list to see if a person in one large-scale database is the same as a person on another large-scale database, that's actually very difficult to do correctly. And all of the efforts that, in particular, Chris Kobach, who's the vice chair of this commission, is the Kansas Secretary of State, that he's been banging this drum on voter fraud and duplicate registrations for a number of years, and an effort that he is involved with called the Interstate Cross-Check Program is rife with errors where they get false positives and they claim that someone who's registered is actually deceased and it turns out to be someone who's alive, that a number of states have pulled back and dropped out of this, the process of doing this kind of matching needs to be done very carefully. It's hard to do accurately, and again, nobody who studies elections seriously thinks that this is likely to produce accurate estimates, in part because most of the people involved in this commission, particularly Kobach, have not been credible and have not been accurate in the past and have made lots of false claims about the nature of the accuracy of this records, voter records.
We're talking right now with Ken Mayer. He's a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he's an affiliate of the Elections Research Center. We're talking about the federal request for voter registration information that has been put on hold right now as challenges in the court system on the legality of the commission's request. Ken, let's focus right now on Wisconsin and what Wisconsin has responded for this request to turn over private voter information. What is happening in this state?
Well, Wisconsin voter registration system has about 3.6 million registrants statewide. And under the law, anybody who wants this information, wants the public parts of the voter registration system, can obtain it if they pay. Buying the whole list costs about $12,500. And that gets you all of the publicly available information for a registered voter, which is basically the name, person's name, their address, and going back to 2006, whether or not they voted, they cast a ballot in an election.
But it doesn't say how they voted.
No, that's not recorded anywhere. And then there are other fields that are in the registration system that are not publicly available, and that includes a person's date of birth. It includes the driver's license or state ID number. if someone uses that to register, or the last four digits of a person's social security number if they use that to register. And that's by law prohibited from being released. And so even if the elections, state elections commission wanted to turn that information over, they would be prohibited from doing so. And also, unlike a lot of states, Wisconsin doesn't have voter registration by party. So when you register, you don't have to declare a party affiliation. So the only things that they would get would be the publicly available data fields. And then again, under the law, the state elections commission is not permitted to deny someone who wants that information from getting it. And Mike Haas, the director of the State Elections Commission, had an op-ed in the State Journal, I think today or yesterday,
Monday,
talking about why. Because there is a transparency and accuracy element that election authorities want to convey, so that people can look at the data to make sure that that it is accurate and cross-check it.
And Ken, as we wrap up very quickly here, some concerns of this: there's been a massive amount of unregistering to vote, states are reporting, people trying to get off voter rolls. As someone who studies this, what is worry? Is that something that we should worry about?
Well, it is worrisome because voter turnout, the whole system ought to be designed to make it easier for people, you know, qualified voters to vote. And the notion that the mere mention or the attempt to try to study this is causing people in, I've seen reports in Arizona and Colorado where people are contacting election authorities to have their names removed. That's a problem, because that means that people don't have confidence in the security of their information, and it doesn't accomplish anything in terms of the integrity of the registration system. That's not a problem in Wisconsin, because we have election day registration. You can register on election day, but that's something that most states don't have. And so my take on this is that the goal here is not to increase the integrity of elections, but to sow chaos and convince people that the whole system is actually insecure, which would make it easier to impose new rules that would make it harder to vote, that actually don't have anything to do with the integrity of the election system.
Ken, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Ken Mayer is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and an affiliate of the Elections Research Center. He joined us to talk about a legal challenge to the president's call for voter information.
Advertising has long been connected with the culture and society at a particular moment, but there are times when efforts to get a message out in a relevant or trendy way just falls flat on its face.
Take a recent example, Kendall and Kylie Jenner. They're best known for appearing on the reality TV show Keeping Up with the Kardashians, modeling, and their Instagram accounts. But lately, the Jenner name is also associated with advertising and marketing campaigns gone wrong.
A few months ago, Kendall Jenner appeared in a Pepsi ad that critics said was an insult to the Black Lives Matter movement and made light of social and political tensions and protests. More recently, it's a lawsuit that both sisters are facing for t-shirts they recently released. The t-shirts featured the Jenners' faces superimposed over music icons like the late rappers Tupac and Notorious B.I.G. and bands like Pink Floyd, Metallica, and Ozzy Osbourne. Eric Thomas joins us now to share his take. He's a senior partner at Saga Marketing, frequently writes about marketing, branding, and diversity. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Let's start with these t-shirts. That's the latest kerfluffle related to these reality TV stars and entrepreneurs. A lawsuit now, a photographer who said his photo of Tupac was used on a shirt being sold for $125 without his permission. But why is it so upsetting to fans to see their favorites, whether it's Pink Floyd or Tupac, on a Kardashian-related t-shirt?
I think there's a number of reasons. A, you earn icon status. It seems like the Kardashians and the Jenners, the Kardashian-Jenners, or whatever exactly that household is called basically right now, they seem to be famous because they're famous. And so there's this running joke that they're not necessarily contributing to society. And as a marketing and brand strategist, I'm actually on their team, right? I understand what it means to build a brand and maintain that. Many people have been famous for the sake of being famous and disappeared, but what they are not are artists that have contributed to the cultural identity or the lexicon of America, like a Pink Floyd or like a Tupac Shakur. And to just take your face and then put it on top of it is the equivalent of taking your face and putting it on top of a religious icon. It doesn't sync up naturally.
One thing that's impressive is, I mean, when you say Pink Floyd, Metallica, Tupac, Notorious B.I.G., you're covering multiple genres and multiple generations of people. You're ticking off here. I mean, they really covered all their bases, didn't they?
Oh yeah, it was a strategic play to piss off as many people as humanly possible. Older people, younger people, black people, white people, music lovers, you know, everybody. It seemed like a couple of young girls saying, oh, this is cool. What if that was me?
Now, as you say, the Jenners aren't the only people trying to build a brand. There are entrepreneurs out there listening. Everybody's trying to brand themselves in some way these days. Are there lessons, and we're not all going to, you know, slap our faces on a Pink Floyd T-shirt, but are there lessons here when we're trying to sell ourselves or our product in a culturally relevant way and not do something that just makes everybody angry?
I mean, the real strategy is, A, really talk to the estates or the families or the icons that you're trying to work with, right? I mean, you're not supposed to be juxtaposing yourself over culturally relevant people. People have built their brands over decades of hard work, and so they are the creators. Work with the creators to create things that are relevant to either their demographic, their core, or the culture that they represent. At the end of the day, great artists are culture creators. And so they know what to do to inspire their audience. Some of them even lose track of it. You know, as you see a star rise, you see a star fall. Even they lose touch with how to continue to stay relevant. So to just take it without even having a conversation with the fan base or the creator is almost disrespectful. And I think that's why you see that type of backlash.
Now, in this case, it was the Jenners themselves. Now, we also mentioned that Pepsi ad. Now, this featured one of the Jenners, Kendall. In this Pepsi ad, she leaves a photo shoot. There's a big protest. It's not clear what the protest is. And she saves the day, I think, by giving a police officer, of course, a Pepsi in the end. Now, this is not a couple young people coming up with a bad idea. This is Pepsi. They've done marketing for, you know, a little while now. What went wrong there?
So first of all, that ad was done in-house. So it was done in a silo. And so it seemed like, you know, those college brochures that just have people of different ethnicities sitting together. But when you go into a college, you very rarely see that. It seemed like they just took a series of different ethnic groups and caricatures of what they would possibly be doing in that moment, and then slid them together and said, hopefully people identify themselves here, without any context to, like, protests are, they tend to be pretty stressful, right? Because people are passionate about whatever they're protesting for. This seemed to almost trivialize whatever you would be protesting for, because I don't think it was a Black Lives Matter protest, right? I think it was a general protest, whether you're looking at the Egyptian Spring, whether you're looking at the Women's March, it was a protest. And some of the shots were literally just the protest in the background of two ladies giggling while drinking a Pepsi. I mean, it was the most trivial use of an emotionally excited moment, blatantly pushing a beverage. And that just, like, that doesn't vibe well with anyone, I don't think.
Now, when this came out, there was a huge online response. A lot of people got angry about that. We could talk about that in a minute. But when all is said and done, is this something that's going to make anybody drink more or less Pepsi?
I don't think so. I think you get a net zero on it. I think the problem is that when you spend a couple of million dollars, you don't want a net zero. I mean, I think it hurts poor Kendall, and it wasn't really her fault. I think she's a young girl who doesn't think about her actual cultural relevance in the world or what her platform she's actually been given, or how, you know, she has a couple of, like, hip hop artist friends. So she thinks she's been given a pass to speak for the culture, which is not necessarily true. Just because you hang out with Tiger, just because you know him, does not mean you are from the neighborhood he's from, endured what he's endured, and been able to speak to a community that he speaks for.
Now, times are different now for, I guess, marketers and advertisers. Once upon a time, you put your advertisement out there, and you had ways via surveys to measure how people reacted. Now the people you're marketing to get to talk back and respond publicly, and the response sometimes can dwarf the initial ad itself. How does that change what advertisers and marketers do?
I think it's about that time for people to start hiring the folks that they're trying to market to. Right. I mean, I think we spend a lot of time doing focus groups, but we don't spend a lot of time actually just hiring people from those target markets and those demographics. And I mean, I spoke at a conference called the 3% Conference, and 3% was when they started that conference. It was the number of women in leadership in advertising, which is a shockingly low number when 50% of the world's population is women. Right. And I think that number is finally up to like 6% or something like that, which is still too low. Advertisers have to stop thinking about it as an advertising pitch and really say we need to diversify across gender, ethnicity, physical ability, sexual identification, all those sorts of things, so that we can have an authentic and genuine way to speak to our demographics. You shouldn't have to have a series of market research studies. You should be able to ask someone in the office, hey, are you able to not only speak to this market, but are you able to gather and communicate and bring a series of people together so that we can have an authentic dialogue on what we're trying to say here?
Before we wrap up, I want to get into a lot of what we're looking at is sort of millennial generation oriented, but baby boomers have seen a lot of this, the Beatles revolution and what was it, a Nike ad. And a big thing, the Janis Joplin song, Mercedes-Benz, eventually used years later in a Mercedes-Benz commercial. Looking back, we've seen a lot of this before.
I mean, at the end of the day, you're going to have cultural hotspots. You're going to have someone who can see that there is something that's culturally relevant going on, and they're gonna push a narrative that's going to become very hot. You're going to have people who are behind them trying to copy that, but not understanding the tiny little idiosyncrasies that come with respecting a culture, celebrating a culture while moving a product. Everyone that falls behind is in danger of crossing that line. And I think that's what you saw here. You saw people talking about protests. You saw people talking about social movements. And then with like the Janis Joplin, you see people talking about America because they were trying to be a hard juxtaposition against being like German. But there was no real understanding of what that meant to American, right? Like, not like the Ram commercials, which are considerably more successful.
We'll leave it there for now. Thanks to Eric Thomas, senior partner at Saga Marketing. He writes about marketing, branding, and diversity.
Conversations about the changing labor market often revolve around technical skills. As automation replaces the industrial workers of the past, the reasoning goes that skills like software development and computer coding are the way of the future.
But tomorrow's workforce could actually rely on emotional labor. Our next guest says that automation isn't replacing the emotional intelligence of human beings, and the demand for jobs requiring these so-called soft skills is on the rise.
Livia Gershon writes about the economics, politics, and everyday life. Her recent piece for Eon Magazine is called The Future is Emotional, and you can find that on the Central Time Facebook page. Livia, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, first of all, let's qualify what we mean here by emotional labor. What is it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a pretty big variety of things that you could call emotional or social work. Some of it is perhaps just in a regular desk job where increasingly people have to work in teams, have to consider what other people are feeling as they're working. But then there's also a huge and growing number of jobs in fields like healthcare where often a lot of the work is really just being there, understanding what a patient is going through and supporting them.
And what are these skills? What are the skills involved in emotional labor? What are we talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, I think people talk a lot about empathy as a skill, that to be really able to be present with someone and to understand the emotions that they are feeling and then to be able to respond appropriately to that. Also, there's skills that involve sort of controlling your own emotional reactions so that if you're dealing with someone who is agitated, say a patient with dementia, someone who's having a lot of difficulty in their lives, to be able to stay calm and be able to work in an appropriate way with them.
We often hear that as manufacturing jobs of the past, as they disappear, that people need to be learning high-tech skills, coding, the engineering skills to survive in the work world. But your narrative is, but you say that, you know, that is a little bit flawed. How so?
Yeah, I mean, I think that certainly some people need to do that work, but I think you are never going to have an entire economy where everyone is a coder or, you know, developing biotech drugs or what have you. An awful lot of people, as those jobs are those jobs are out there, but in addition, there are so many jobs for people who are caring for each other.
And even coders work on teams that mm-hmm. they have to have some of that empathy or someone who works with someone else or even in customer service.
Yeah, I think that's true. There's very, very few jobs, especially now, that where you're just isolated completely from other people.
So are we already seeing an increased demand for these jobs requiring soft skills and emotional work?
Yeah, absolutely. When people do surveys of big companies, big employers. They say that soft skills are the biggest thing that's in demand among employers. And then also you see these whole sectors. The healthcare sector is growing, and within the healthcare sector, the jobs that are growing the most are direct care work, like home care workers and nurses aides and people who are, their job involves a lot of interaction with individual patients.
So are we finding that there is a readily available supply of people with these skills?
Well, I think that's interesting. I think in a way, yes. The great thing about emotional labor is that it's something that I think almost everyone has to some extent. Most people do enjoy dealing with other people, do enjoy feeling that they're helping other people. But it's not a kind of work that often is well compensated, that it's not understood to be important skills. And so I think that's the difficulty, is that you have people who are doing these jobs very well often, but then sometimes they're not being paid enough to really get by. And that can be a problem for being able to do your job well as well.
Why have these skills been undervalued? Is there a history here?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, these are skills that often have been associated with women and associated with unpaid jobs. So it's skills of a parent, the skills of caring for an elderly parent, you know, your elderly parent. You know, even being a secretary is often sort of, there's an emotional element of that, of being social, of supporting your boss. That's historically been understood to be part of that job, but yet it's not really compensated for the emotional work that you're doing there.
We're talking right now with Livia Gershon, and her piece in Eon Magazine is titled The Future is Emotional. We're talking about emotional labor and how it impacts the workforce, how it is valued or not valued in the workforce. What, you know, in terms of healthcare, there, as you mentioned, personal health aides and home health aides and so much of the care in home and in everything from long-term care facilities and assisted living facilities relies on this emotional type of labor. Why are people going into these type of jobs that are very difficult and underpaid?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of fear, I think, in the industry of people hiring that for those jobs, that people will not want to continue going into those jobs, particularly as the baby boomers age and there's a lot more demand for people taking care of the elderly. So that's a big concern for a lot of people. I think a lot of people go into it because they care, truly. Like, I've talked to people who say, you know, I could work in, you know, making phone calls for some kind of marketing campaign, and I could maybe make a little more money that way, but I want to be doing something where I'm supporting and helping other people. But the terrible thing about that is that then those jobs are often so underpaid that people are really being exploited.
Is there any way to turn that around? Is there any way to fix that problem and make emotional labor more valuable in the workforce?
Yeah, I mean, I think particularly when it comes to healthcare, that we have to understand that even in our present system, a lot of healthcare is paid for one way or another through the government. You know, the government supports employer-sponsored insurance, provides Medicaid, Medicare, all these things. And yet, often we don't, as a society, say we want to devote money specifically to paying low-paid workers, and that could be done. It could be rules put into how Medicaid is paid and things of that sort to say that a certain amount of this money has to go to providing living wages to people.
What might that do to the economy? Is there any research out there that would show what might happen to our productivity?
Yeah, I mean, I think the word productivity is very interesting there, because when you talk about productivity, a lot of times what you're talking about is kind of squeezing the most work you can out of people and paying, you know, in some cases not necessarily paying more for that productivity. I mean, I think what needs to happen is that we need to understand that these are valuable functions that are being done for our society, and that they should be paid for. And you know, as with many things, it kind of goes back to the growing inequality and the amount of money that is going into the capital to people who are own stock in companies, for example, rather than to workers.
Some jobs that we might not think of right away as emotional labor actually require a lot of these skills. One you mentioned is police work. How does that fit in?
Yeah, policing, I think the figure is about 80% of the time that police officers spend in their job is working with people, sort of maybe mediating a family dispute, getting called because someone is having a mental illness problem, things of that sort. And yet, that's not primarily what the police are trained to respond to. They're trained to fight crime. So it's very important that those functions of intervening be done by people who are well prepared to be able to do that kind of emotional work of working with someone who's going through a crisis one way or another.
And many police forces around the country do grapple with pay, that these jobs are not paid well enough.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's another job that is a social service that is paid for through the government, and that perhaps the funding just isn't there that should be.
And so what is the takeaway message for social services here? Because so much it revolves around people, emotional skills, and working with people.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we need to place more value on that. I think one of the interesting responses that I've gotten to writing this essay is people in tech jobs in Silicon Valley, people sharing this. And I think it's very interesting how much people in these technology-driven jobs are understanding that their work is not the only work, and that to have a functioning society in which we can have these wonderful technological advances, we need to be taking care of everyone. We need to be educating young children and doing all these jobs that do involve a huge amount of social and emotional work.
We're talking that right now with Olivia Gershon. She recently wrote about the growing demand for emotionally intelligent people to fill positions like in-home nursing and personal care work, jobs that she says are currently undervalued and underpaid.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. In your work, how important is emotional intelligence? How important are those interpersonal or so-called soft skills in the job you do? Did you feel like you came in prepared to do that job? Do you feel like other people are prepared when they come into your line of work? If you're an employer, what importance do you place on these soft skills, on the emotional intelligence? And do we take them seriously enough? Do we compensate people well enough in jobs that require a lot of these kind of skills? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Olivia Gershon. You can find her recent article for Eon Magazine on the Central Time Facebook page. She makes the case that advanced technical skills aren't the only thing needed for jobs in the future. She says workers with emotional intelligence and compassion are going to be in really high demand.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think jobs like personal care work and in-home nursing are undervalued and underpaid? If you're an employer, do you look for workers who have these, quote, soft skills? Do you work in a job that's emotionally taxing or involves making personal connections with people? How does that feel? And if so, what drew you to your job and what challenges are you facing? Join in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Let's go to Eric now in Neenah. Hi, Eric.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Well, I work as a healthcare provider at the Wisconsin Veterans Home, and this conversation really struck a chord in me just because of the fact that One thing that I think many people lose sight of is that the emotional aspects of work and life play a role in not only healthcare provided, but in all other professions, but more so in the providing of care in a long-term care facility, because you're dealing with the emotions of the individual you're caring for, as well as your own personal emotions, which can cause a barrier to that empathy when you're in the workplace. And I've noticed time and again the issue of real emotional burnout.
And I want to Eric, I'm going to stop you there. Emotional burnout, Livia, what do you think that there is a threat to that with emotional in labor?
Absolutely. I definitely agree with that. I think what Eric's describing is something that you hear from healthcare providers of all kinds. And I think one of the things that is really needed, and maybe Eric can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but that people need support. People need, potentially counseling in some cases, and people need time off. People need to be able to not be incredibly stressed out at their job. You have, doctors working 80-hour weeks, and you wonder why they can't kind of sit there and be emotionally present with someone. It's incredibly difficult if you're being worked that hard.
And education and training are considered a pathway to many careers, but a lot of direct care positions don't require a college degree, and these emotional skills can basically seem more innate. Do you think there's a way to learn how to do this work, or do we simply have to value the skills that people are born with?
I think there is some evidence that people can learn it. There's a lot of work, particularly with doctors, being done to help doctors to develop empathy. One of the things that really struck me is that some of these have doctors read literature and try to, empathize in that way, which I think is an interesting idea. And some schools are now doing more with social and emotional learning for kids, trying to encourage them to work through, design the rules of your classroom yourselves, or find ways to mediate disputes between different kids. I think that all that is quite valuable.
And when you say reading literature, what are these physicians reading to develop this skill set?
Oh, that's a really good question. I don't know exactly what they had them read. I'm trying to think. I think some sort of kind of classics of Western literature is my memory, but I'm blanking on what any of the specifics might have been.
And we have a comment here on Facebook. Single-payer healthcare would solve this and so many of our problems. Time we align with the rest of the free world in providing care for all our citizens. That comment comes from Matt in Wausau. Single-payer healthcare, would that lead to more soft skills, emotional care, labor, and more value on that?
Yeah, in my opinion, yeah, I think that is crucial. That in some way, providing care to everyone is important for many reasons, and in part, yeah, it's because we need to have that funding stream that people are being paid adequately. So a single payer plan that was well funded would absolutely help, I think.
Japan has the oldest population in the world, and the government has invested heavily in developing these care bots, those robots meant for helping the elderly with household tasks. Could that supplant some of the jobs we're talking about?
I think that's a really interesting idea. I find it pretty hard to imagine that could really supplant a lot of these jobs, because at least as artificial intelligence exists now, I can't imagine that if you're having a health flare-up of some kind or an emotional crisis, that it would be satisfactory to talk to Siri, so to speak, about that.
Yeah. And is making personal care more highly credentialed, making these jobs with more credentials and perhaps more seniority, is that a way to increase their value?
I think that is an idea that a lot of people have, is the idea of, in Washington, D.C., for example, they're now saying that preschool and childcare workers need to have a degree, a bachelor's degree, I believe. I don't think that's necessarily the most valuable way to go about these things. I don't think that you can necessarily really learn these skills in a classroom, and I think the things that help people to successfully do social and emotional work is much more about the kind of support that they're given in their job. So I think being adequately paid, having adequate time off, having support is the most important thing.
What about role models in the workplace? Is it good to perhaps have CEOs and supervisors who have these soft skills?
I think so, yeah, for sure. And I think most actually CEOs and people who provide suggestions for what CEOs should do are very aware of that and talk a lot about these soft skills. So I think that is important. I think also it's important to have people in top leadership positions who are not just absolutely working 24/7 to have set that example for people as well.
And what kind of example should they set with these skills that you're talking about, with the empathy? And how does that translate into real-world experience in the workplace?
I think there's just some things that probably everyone's heard of doing, but trying to talk using I statements and doing things of that sort, I think, is valuable for being able to communicate in ways where you're not hurting people's feelings and maybe not successfully being able to work as a team.
We're talking right now with Livia Gershon. She has a new piece in Eon Magazine, and it's about emotional care and the labor market around the future of emotional skills in the workplace. You can call in with your comments, 800-642-1234. Do you think these jobs like personal care work and in-home nursing are undervalued and underpaid? And if you're an employer, do you look for workers who have these soft skills? Join in, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Robin now in Birchwood. Hi, Robin.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I was just thinking that anybody, no matter what your profession is or no matter what your job is, being emotionally in tune with your coworkers is a really big deal. And genuine care, if you genuinely care for the people that you work with, they will cooperate. They'll be much easier to get along with. The job that I do, sometimes I have to ask people to do things that maybe they don't really want to do.
And what job is that, may I ask?
Well, I'm an FSQ auditor. And I work with, you know, the overnight sanitation crew. After they've worked all night long cleaning, I come in and say, oh, you missed a spot here, you missed a spot there. And I always feel like I have to be really gentle with them, you know, and help them to understand that I appreciate what they do, because it seems so thankless, you know, like, oh, I've been here all night long, and now, you know, oops, you got to re-clean this and you got to re-clean that. And in the rooms that I audit, the people that I work with during the day, it seems to really build a good relationship to care and to understand, you know, if I have to ask them to do something that maybe they're not really thrilled about, like, oh, you know, you need to put your safety glasses on, or oops, you forgot your earplugs.
Well, Robin, thank you so much for calling in and sharing those examples in your workplace. Livia, what about walking a mile in someone else's shoes?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's empathy. And I think Robin sounds like a great example of someone who is really doing that, really being empathetic and being able to do her job better because she has those skills to do that. I don't envy anybody who has to do that kind of work where you have to correct someone who maybe has made a mistake and things like that. That's so hard to do. But I think those skills are absolutely crucial for that.
Robin, thanks so much for calling in. Let's take a really quick call. Lane in Wind Lake. Go ahead. Hi, Lane.
Hi.
Really quickly, are you there?
Yeah, I was just saying, my wife worked as a nurse's assistant, and just the stuff that she brought home to me was hard to deal with.
Oh, wow. So, Lane and Livia, you're saying then that you bring that home and it affects people in your family. Livia, we're going to have to jump off here. Thanks so much for joining us today. That was Livia Gershon. Her recent article on emotional skills in the workplace is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. While you're there, you can weigh in on this topic on the Central Time Facebook page.
Yesterday at this time, we asked you where up north is in Wisconsin, and since then you've given us lots of answers.
The starting point was this online map from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that lets you draw the dividing line and decide where up north begins.
And that link is still up on the Central Time Facebook page, and so are lots of your responses. Here's a sample we heard from Joe, kind of metaphorical here, but a practical thing. When the gravel on the side of the road changes from limestone yellow to granite red. And that is a good divider.
I will observe next time.
Definitely.
And then there was Arnie. I go with 50 miles north of your primary residence.
So north is relevant to where you're starting. That makes a lot of sense. Thanks for that, Arnie. Jenny says, in Lake Geneva, I definitely feel like an imposter who doesn't really live in Wisconsin. I'm madly in love with this state, but the really good stuff is way up north for me. Now, I think we can all clearly consider Lake Geneva an official part of Wisconsin. You can rest easy, Jenny.
Brokaw and north, that's where the trees and evergreens become more dense.
That from Karen. Okay. And then Joe says, anything north of Milwaukee and Madison, that's basically Illinois. Anyway, fighting words from Joe for people in southern Wisconsin.
You can still share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. Keep them coming, and we want to figure out where this dividing line is.
This is the Ideas Network.